นะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะบุตถังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิOkay, so this evening is the full moon Vesaka Puja and the commemoration of the Buddha's birth as enlightenment, his passing away. So it's a major festival day in Theravada tradition, and great opportunity to recollect the Buddha as a refuge, the and I think it's helpful to have that context of the Buddha. In terms of somebody who was born, somebody who was awakened, somebody who died, and that puts it into the realm of a very human experience, and well, except for the enlightenment bit, but. And that holds out the possibility for all of the all of us, in that the Buddha was a human being and had all of the experiences really that we have, but he set his intentions on the experience of awakening, and did. But also, by extension, that opens up the same possibility for us, because what the Buddha was awakened to was the a truth that is a part of this human condition within the realm of birth, aging, sickness, death, of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensation, of skillful, unskillful mental formations, one can be awakened, and that we have all of that. We have these five aggregates of being: form, perception, feeling, mental formations, consciousness, in the same way that the Buddha did. And particularly in say the early texts and the primary, say, designation of the Buddha was Arahant, in the sense of one who is worthy, one who is far from defilement, and that in this and that is something that all awakened beings have that same quality, far from defilement, worthy beings, Arahants. because it's taken on a certain, in Buddhist history, a certain pejorative connotation, but the original usage was actually one that was, say, predates the Buddha as a spiritual ideal. That quest for freedom, liberation, purification, and it was something that this path that the Buddha laid out for us gives the opportunity to access, to experience ourselves, so that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha is giving final instructions, is pointing to the fact that anybody who practices this Noble Eightfold Path can realize the fruits of it. So that anybody who picks up this path of practice, of training in virtue, integrity, samadhi, concentration, wisdom, discernment, it's that path that provides the basis for transformation. And so it's definitely a message of encouragement and one of hope, in the sense that if we put forth the effort and put forth the kind of sincere application, we'll experience the fruits of that. We'll reap the fruits of that. Say, it's a natural result. One of the ways that Ajahn Chah depicted it or gave an image for was that in the same way that there's water in the ground, and whoever digs a well they'll be able to reach that water and to be able to use that water for whatever purpose they want. So similarly, there is this truth that exists and it's accessible through this path of practice, of training, sila, samadhi, panya. So that the message of the Buddha is one of giving us the tools for experiencing this taste of freedom. So when we speak about effort, sometimes we interpret that if I just try hard enough, then I'll experience the fruits of this path. But this is a middle way, and it's a there's a subtlety to it. On all aspects of the of that path, the sense of precepts, just trying to keep every little nuance of the precepts and trying to be quote unquote pure can sometimes just make oneself insufferable, and it doesn't necessarily purify if one is, it doesn't have a balance and understand, say what the precepts are for, because the precepts are for, of course, establishing a quality of non-harming, of integrity, creating bonds of trust within our relationships with our fellow human beings, but also they're also for, in terms of purpose, leading on to samadhi, on to peaceful states of mind, and so sometimes we can hold something good so tight that we create suffering, we create agitation in the mind, so that the holding to the precepts has to be a holding that is again this balance, this middle way, and that holding like. If you pick up a small bird or a small animal, you actually have to hold it fairly firmly, but you can't hold too tightly. You can't hold too loosely either, because they're ready to fly off or run away or whatever. But there does need to be a certain firmness, but it can't be too tight. So that image which we all have experienced, where you know there's a certain subtlety of how we approach this holding of this little animal, and it's the same with our holding of the precepts. We have to hold them firmly. You can't hold them tightly. You can't hold them too lackadaisically either. That holding in a way that is investigating and paying attention. What are the fruits? What's the result? What do I feel like when I'm holding to a certain standard of conduct of body and speech? Does it make for a sense of well-being, and to be able to relinquish impulses of unskillfulness, impulses of harming, impulses of greed, so that when we have that restraint, there's a sense of relief that comes. And sometimes there is a little bit of a struggle, but still, the overall sense is a sense of well-being. And then, of course, the result of that is also over a longer term, is this sense of trust. And a trust in oneself, a trust in others or with others, having that sense of trust is again another aspect of well-being, where we living together with others with a sense of ease, because of this bonds of trust, but sometimes it doesn't even mean you have to like somebody, but you can trust them. That's a big deal. It's not a small thing. I think one of the when we think of the middle way, the aspects of happiness is oftentimes overlooked, in a sense. You know, we try so hard to figure it out, or we try so hard to get it just right, and the aspect of happiness and well-being is an important factor in brightening the mind, so that it's at ease, it's open, the mind and the heart are spacious. That one of the fruits of that commitment to virtue and integrity is happiness and well-being. And similarly, in terms of meditation, there's a very beautiful quote when the Buddha reflecting on his own life, or recounting to in one of the discourses. Is recounting to another religious seeker from another sect at the time of the Buddha, and kind of he was depicted as an ascetic, kind of argumentative type. And the Buddha, talking about his own experience, both in terms of his renunciation, his leaving his comfortable life in the world, and then striving in various ways of practice and just finding frustration and it's pretty spectacular what he did in terms of self-control doing without things and forcing the mind. I mean, there's account of the Buddha, you know, starving himself and doing different ascetic practices and trying to cultivate, say, the concentration of not breathing. It's not much fun. And in the account, and the Buddha speaking of having this memory of when he was a child and being at a ceremony. And of course, in Buddhist art, it's a very common theme. They say the Buddha, as a young boy, under the rose apple tree, and the kind of the plowing festival taking place, with his father presiding over it, and the Buddha, or the Buddha to be, sitting and going into samadhi, and experiencing the bliss of samadhi. But anyway, the Buddha is recounting his recollection coming up, this memory of that, and when he's finding this, all of his ascetic striving, kind of fruitless, and then thinking, you know, there was this happiness of concentration, there was this happiness of kind of balance and ease and non-concern, various things coming together, but the distinctive flavor of it was this quality of happiness and well-being. And the Buddha sort of thinking, maybe, and he said, maybe that's the path. And he said, and that is the path. And that sense of being able to allow the mind to come together in that stable, calm clarity, experiencing ease and well-being, and then realizing he's not going to be able to sustain that with his body being so emaciated. And then that was embarking on this other approach to practice, where he was really balanced in his different faculties, both physical and mental. But this sense of happiness and ease being an important quality. And of course we need to pay attention to, you know, the Buddha encourages that. But it's also it's that happiness and ease that comes from a skillful application of the mind. An application of the mind of course, the key is mindfulness, awareness, but also a self-reflection. And there's a whole series of discourses that the Buddha gives, where he speaks about the central role of happiness and well-being, and sometimes it has different roots or has different causes. Sometimes it's through sila, or wholesome sila, kusala sila, so that sort of through virtue, through keeping conduct that's skillful. Sometimes it's through faith, devotion, confidence. Sometimes it's through investigation, reflection, yoniso manasikara, wise attention, reflecting on experience. Whatever starting point there is, and of course we need to pursue all of those, the Buddha goes into a kind of series of stock phrases that, with these different starting points, then there's the arising of delight, pamoja, and that quality of delight, the quality of well-being. And you can feel that sometimes just as a physical sensation. It's where it's like, you know, sometimes where you're just because of circumstances in terms of nature that you're in, or the mind has been settled for some reason or something, there's a real delight that one experiences. But then with delight as the cause and condition, then there's the arising of of joy. And piti. And joy is in joy, bliss, and sort of a mental, emotional experience of exhilaration. Is another word, because sometimes everything sort of brightens and sense of well-being. And with piti as the basis, and Buddha points to the arising of tranquility and pasati, which is there's piti, joy or bliss. I mean, it's quite exciting, and so it can be quite stimulating, and then that can be both physically sort of energy coursing through the body, but also the mind can be kind of ramped up because of that. So then tranquility is important. It doesn't mean that one isn't experiencing well-being or happiness, but there's a settled quality to it. There's a certain sense of ease that's both physical and mental. And the Buddha pointing that out, that they say this tranquility leads to happiness, sukha. And of course, sukha is the, say, direct opposite of dukkha. And so that there's this sense of body, mind, experiencing well-being, happiness, in a very deep sense. But it's from that the Buddha points to with sukha as the basis, as the rising of samadhi and concentration, sense of firm establishing of the mind. And in some of the discourses, the Buddha actually stops and says explicitly, the happy mind is easily concentrated. And I think that's so important for us as practitioners to pay attention to that, because I think most of us get easily locked into a paradigm of you know, if I could just get my meditation together, I'd be happy, and the Buddha has a completely opposite approach. Sense that if you can get your happiness together, then your meditation starts to really grow, starts to really take root. And of course, the happiness that the Buddha is pointing at is not, you know, some random gratification of some obsession that we have, but this is. The happiness that comes from really focusing on what is wholesome, what is skillful, what is beneficial, both for oneself and for others. Because you can't separate that. And as we pay attention to that, tune into that, and really cultivate those qualities or those conditions that allow for the heart to really be at ease and experience delight and joy, without trying to Sometimes we, you know, you see that sometimes when you're meditating, or in regular circumstances, there's sort of, you know, some little bit of delight shows up, or some little bit of joy, and just grab onto that and try to squeeze it for what it's worth and get as much out of it as possible. That doesn't work. And so we really have to, that stepping back and seeing that as a process that is harmless, in the sense of, you know, when we see it from the perspective of causes and conditions, a process of causes and conditions, as opposed to me and my gratification, or me and my missing out on my gratification, then we're able to recognize how natural it is, and then how beneficial it is. That tuning into the truth of the pleasant. It's also just being able to tune into what is, say the fruits of when we allow the mind to become settled and still, and then reflect on relinquishment, and really reflect on letting go. And see, like one of the, I would say, when the Buddha speaks of dispassion, disenchantment, there's the words that he uses. So, this is peaceful. This is sublime. This relinquishment of all formations, the stilling of all desire, dispassion, cessation, nibbana, and sort of, so that sense. Oh yeah, this is not something that is, you know, some sort of, it's going to zap you, and you're going to sort of, you know, ride this one for what it's worth. This is peaceful. This is sublime, and to be able to be willing to turn attention to that quality. So that then, you know, as we cultivate this middle way, that this, it's both a middle way of practice, it's a middle way of view. That too, as we approach this middle way of practice, just paying attention to the, you know, the effort that we put in, the, you know, the laziness that we have, the difficulties that we have, obstacles that come up, and how do we come back to a middle way of putting forth effort, just dealing with precepts and impulses and obsessions that we know are unskillful, and then the inner lawyers trying to find some logical way to get around it. But I said, okay, how do we find a middle way where we can hold to this quality of integrity without it being oppressive for ourselves or as I said, insufferable for others? And realize, the Buddha is giving us the tools for us to experience happiness and well-being. And same in the meditation. It's the you know, we can tie ourselves up in knots trying to be mindful, but to notice that, to recognize it, that Okay, there I'm tying myself in a knot again, trying to be mindful, trying to be the good meditator. Or where one is okay, there, oh, wow. You just notice, oh, there I am, drifting off again. I started trying to be mindful, and it's gone. You know, where'd it go? Where'd it go? And so it's really tracking it down, paying attention to it, but not trying to say oppress the mind. But sort of like, oh, it's like a path of exploration, of discovery. And seeing, because it's like discovering the mind of awareness and clarity. Well, it's a wonderful discovery, because you know it's just so easy to be distracted and you know, obsessed about whatever, but it is, we don't have to be locked into that, and just picking up something simple. The meditation objects that the Buddha gives us are, you know, in general quite simple, in the sense of, okay, pay attention to the breath coming in, breath going out, pay attention to the body, pay attention to the nature of the elements. Contemplation of say impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, loving kindness, compassion as an object of attention. I mean, they're on a certain level, they're quite simple, quite straightforward, and. You know, problem is our minds are complicated. So we, using the meditation object to keep returning to in order to keep clarifying and settling so that we can shed those complications. And also it's shining a light on the complications that we throw up, we keep obscuring. We obscure our experience of peace and clarity, and just the things that get thrown up into the mind. So that as our meditation isn't, again, it's not so much about trying to achieve or accomplish to gain a particular state of mind, but you know, having the trust that when we relinquish the obstacles and stick with the application of attention, then that gives us an opportunity to settle the mind and see clearly. Again, it's like the water is there in the ground. All we have to do is dig the well. The experience of peace and liberation is within our own hearts, and we just have to keep returning to it, or keep relinquishing the obstacles that we believed in for so long. Like having believed in some story or fantasy, and then at some point you say, "Well, that was just a story. It's just a fantasy, and didn't have anything to do with reality or truth or anything." And then one can drop it. But the Buddha's his life, his teaching, was the especially on a day like today, Visakha Puja, commemoration of the Buddha's birth, his awakening, his passing away. It's a recollection of the central place that the Buddha has in Buddhism, because Buddhism can turn into a religion. But the Buddha really didn't teach Buddhism, he just taught truth. So that they being able to come back to those truths that the Buddha pointed to, and his life is his example, the reality of him being a historical figure, opens the way for us to be able to experience exactly the same thing. I think this is something that is easily kind of dismissed or not quite believed in, it's been a central piece of the Buddha's dispensation from the earliest days. That to be reflecting on the example of the Buddha, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, and again those qualities are all qualities that we have the capacity to embody, we inherit this legacy of also being one who can awaken, and it's no small thing. In the over the winter retreat, we did readings from the upcoming biography of Ajahn Chah, and something that Ajahn Chah really emphasized, this sort of immediacy of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as refuge, and to try to lift that up. And realize that is a possibility that we can choose to take. When we taking Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha as refuge, not just as a ceremony or a ritual or some quaint historical thing, but something that we're doing on a heart basis. And realizing that when we do that, when we incline the heart to those qualities that are refuge, our heart transforms, and it's no small thing. Particularly on a day like Visakha Puja, it's important to reflect and to recollect and to reestablish that kind of commitment to the qualities of the Buddha, embodying the qualities of the Buddha in one's day-to-day life, and not in a it's not as if it's a grandiose statement to do that. It's what the Buddha encouraged his disciples in his time to do And it's the legacy that we inherit to this day. I think the teachings have lasted over 2,500 years because people have put their effort and attention into embodying these qualities and realizing the fruits of the path. Offer that for reflection this evening.
Andamayam Dhammakaya Sadhu Kram Dhammasay. Sadhu.